Welcome to the 2015 Retail Marketing Virtual Conference and Expo. My name is Melissa Campanelli, and I'm Editor-in-Chief and Editorial Content Director for Total Retail, and I'm pleased to welcome you to this session, Crossing the Border, Global E-Commerce Tips, Tricks, and Strategies. Have you started mapping out your global e-commerce strategy yet? If not, maybe you should. After all, global web sales will account for 6% of worldwide retail next year and more than 9% in 2018, according to a recent eMarketer report. If you need a helpful hand to guide you through the challenges of global e-commerce, then this session is for you. Today, Carl Miller, Managing Director of Global Retail Insights Network, a not-for-profit global community for e-commerce professionals, and Samantha Kent, Director of International Thrillist Media Group, will discuss challenges and success stories around global e-commerce. Today you'll learn best practices around taking your retail business international, the importance of going global and being local at the same time, how to do business in China, and international payments and shipping logistics tips and tricks. Before we get started, let me take a second to point out the tips for attendees widget on your console. It's the blue one with the wrench on it. If you missed the Tech Tips video we played leading up to this session, you can always click on the widget for more information. So, without further ado, let me introduce you to Carl Miller, the founder and managing director of Global Retail Insights Network, also known as GRIN. Take it away, Carl.
Thank you so much, Melissa. It's been great to be part of the event so far, and we're really looking forward to sharing about our experiences of working with other retailers as they go global. So once again, we're really privileged and honored to have Samantha Kent here. She's the Director of International for Thrillist, but most of you would know, you know, one of the major projects that Thrillist is involved with at this point is Jack Threads. So we're really excited to have an opportunity to learn from Samantha about what she's been doing over the last few years. So a little bit about the Global Retail Insights Network, or as we like to call it, the GRIN. As Melissa mentioned, we are a nonprofit membership organization, and our entire focus, our passion, is to work with retailers and to help them grow cross-border. And so the work that we do is all centered around knowledge, so knowledge sharing and collaboration. We're really, you know, we've talked to several hundred retailers over the last several years, and we really love the opportunity to share with them, you know, our knowledge, but then also obviously learn from them. You know, one of the things, as and just real quick, what I'm doing here is I'm actually pulling up a poll that if you could take a look at this and answer, respond to this question. You know, there's the opportunity to say which countries that you're currently servicing international clients in. Or if, for example, that you're not servicing any, you could click on the last one where it says nowhere. But if you could do that now, and then what I'll do is I'll share with you, the when we go into a retailer and they're doing cross-border business, one of the things that, we look at is what are the factors that make a cross-border retailer successful? And what we found is that for successful cross-border retailers, the ones that are really sort of knocking it out of the park globally, there's two main factors or two main characteristics of those retailers. And the first one is that they really do have sort of a process or a design around localization. And the second characteristic is that they have a culture of a true sort of open culture around collaboration and innovation. And so one specific example of what that would look like is they really do see their vendors and those that they're working with as strategic partners and not just, you know, a vendor to, you know, nickel and dime on a specific, you know, line item of a price point, for example. So hopefully all of you have had an opportunity to view all the options within the poll. You can scroll down to look at, you know, all the options. And now we're going to move on to look at the results. Interesting. So 30% of the audience is doing some business in Canada and about 15% in Europe. Excellent. Well, that's really good to know. And then in Asia, and let me scroll down here, where we have about 7% of the audience doing business in Latin America, and about 50%, so 46% or so, aren't doing business currently globally. So that's a great to know. It does make up in a lot of ways, the general stats that we see in North America a lot of times, that the first entry for a lot of retailers, cross-border retailers, is into Canada and other English-speaking countries. So let's start with one of the most impressive slides you will ever see, this dot. This dot represents a lot of times, it's really great, right? This is the decision that the executives that are going global that they have to make. They have to basically say, where are we going to put all of our resources into? Our technical resources, our legal resources, regulatory, all of our resources into when going global. And the dot essentially ends up looking like this. It's a push pin, right? It's a push pin in a country that we're moving into or that we're already in. And the important part about this dot is that a lot of times retailers focus on all of the output that has to be put into accomplishing the goal of being in this other country. And it's significant. It's logistics and payments and translation and regulatory and all the stuff that goes into going into this other country. And I would say that in general, what we see is like 95% of the retailer's time and effort and goals are focused on this output. And so eventually they have their push pins on a globe somewhere in the world, and they've accomplished maybe going into Canada in this case, right? Or the UK or Australia. But the real global story, and I think the real successful retailers, the ones that are, do have a real process and design around localization. And they do have that open culture of communication and innovation, those two qualities that make successful cross-border retailers. They realize that the actual output is part of the job, but the outcome is equally as important. And that outcome obviously has much more to do with that intimate understanding of that global consumer. And we may think, for example, that we know Canada, but ultimately, there's so many things that we may not know about that Canadian consumer. So it's important when we initially start the journey of going global that we start asking ourselves the questions, you know, do we have local advisors and people that we're talking to in country that really understand that local consumer journey? And are we putting together and starting to develop a process and design around localization? What does that even look like? And, you know, I exaggerate to a certain degree, but to the really successful retailers, I mean, they do spend, you know, a significant amount of their energy. I don't know if it's always 50-50, but a significant amount of their energy really focused on the outcome that they're looking for in going into that specific country, realizing that, yes, they do need to have, you know, logistics and translations and all those things, but ultimately it's that consumer that's the center of the universe there. And understanding that consumer and putting some design in your organization around how to approach that consumer is critically important. So that's really one of the reasons why we brought Samantha Kent here today, is to talk to us about the path and the real path directly from a retailer about what it's like to go global. And she's got successes along the way, failures along the way, and we're so excited to have her here. So once again, Samantha, welcome to the conversation. And I put this slide up, but you don't need to start here, but we're very interested in learning from you about, you know, what the beginning of that exploration is, and then you can sort of move us through the journey over the next 30 minutes or so.
Sure, absolutely. Hi, everyone. I'm thrilled to be here. And be able to share some of our insights. As Carl mentioned, I've worked with a number of different retailers, currently working on checkreds.com, helping them with their international expansion, And for as many successes as I've seen with clients, I've also seen a lot of failures in a lot of scenarios where we've gone in one way and had to completely pivot things and take another direction, simply by not giving the necessary resources and time to international that we have to our domestic businesses, wherever those may be. So a lot of people generally ask me, where do we even start with thinking about taking our services internationally? And typically what I've seen from most of the retailers that I've worked with is they just start by looking at their web traffic and where customers are coming from and where are they missing opportunities, or they're reading articles in the paper and, you know, there's all the buzz about China, or they think Canada's easy, it's just right across the border. But they're not really asking themselves the question about what their brand is and why a customer outside of their domestic market might actually be interested in their product. And oftentimes not answering that question up front can lead you down a path that may or may not be the right path for you entering a new market. So I like to call this cross-border 101. And to me, it's really just about understanding what your value proposition is to a customer in any other market outside of where you are. Identifying that is super important to understanding how to start and how to start capitalizing on existing value while you work on developing additional value that may not be present like it is in your domestic market. So some of the things that actually drive consumers in certain markets to shop across their own border is first and foremost global visibility. We're really all global, whether we want to be or not. The fact that we have an online presence makes us visible to customers all over the globe, and whether or not we choose to capitalize on that and choose to service that is a reality of the existing landscape today. Beyond that, it's very much, very similar to how you shop when you travel abroad. So you're a U.S. citizen and you're traveling abroad to another country, think about the reasons why you would buy a product while you're on vacation somewhere and bring it back to the U.S. Or why you would be driven into a store. One answer might be brand equity. So it's a big brand, a Macy's. Think about the people that travel in New York to Herald Square and just to go see Macy's and see that experience. Brand equity is a big thing, and it's something that a lot of brands underestimate, some of the big names, and a lot of brands overestimate. They assume that they have the same awareness outside of the U.S. that they do domestically. And there's really no reason a customer would know about a brand unless you have a cachet and a certain brand equity already built up. The second thing might be unique product. Do you sell something that nobody else in the world sells? Do you have something that's so novel that they just can't get their hands on it there? And you may even sell something that's not necessarily unique, but that is just too difficult to get in their domestic market. And the last piece of the puzzle that drives consumers across borders is price. Maybe your product, they know about you, you have some brand equity, but they can get your product in country, but it's actually a lot cheaper to buy it online from another country than it is in their own market. And you typically see a lot of these type of pricing discrepancies in very remote locations. Australia is a great example of that, where I've done this with a handful of retailers, where you actually do a comparison of your product, even brand to brand or category level, and see what the pricing is through distributors in Australia versus in the United States. And oftentimes there's massive shifts, differences in pricing, sometimes up to 100%+. So for somebody in Australia to order from a site in the U.S., even if they have to pay a ton for shipping to get it down there, it still may cost them less than if they were to buy that product domestically. So, and I very much think of these in this order. Without brand equity, nobody can find you. And then you think about product availability, and price is really the last component. And oftentimes, retailers focus just on price without thinking through the rest of it, and sort of jump into new markets with this field of dreams idea that if you build it, they'll come. And then customers don't come because their product's not unique and they have no brand equity. So I really like to kind of think about it in this pecking order here. And depending on where your particular brand falls, or your product, you can figure out then how to capitalize on that existing value proposition while you then figure out how to develop a full global strategy. Carl, if you can go into the next slide.
Well, I just had a quick question real quick,
if
you don't mind. So with brand
equity,
like what are some simple ways that that we can, you know, get a better idea? I mean, you mentioned sort of like the customer heat map, like we're seeing customers from a certain country. But is there a way to get a simple idea of, you know, whether or not we're, you know, sort of in the brand equity game and people recognize us in a country, or?
Sure. I mean, measuring brand awareness is always very difficult. It's one of those kind of intangible things that you don't really know. Certainly your site traffic is part of it. And really I think trying to do your best to get on the ground in a market, and see what else is out there and where you would even fit in to know if there's a reason why customers would be driven to your brand naturally. But it's really a very kind of evasive thing to figure out is what your actual brand penetration is in a new market. And typically visitors to your site is the best indication of that.
And so if you're not seeing any movement in a marketplace, well, let's say it's pretty obvious you don't, you know, have that any sort of brand recognition. Is it then really just a matter of the equation of, wow, what's it going to take to, you know, start to acquire these customers, to build that up? I mean, it's basically the starting block, right? So is it generally in your experience, I mean, if you don't have that going for you, is it easier to say no to a country, or how does that all work?
Sure. It's a lot easier to say no to a country, but there's still a lot that you can do while you build brand equity. What it really comes down to is how expensive it's going to be to make serious headway in a market when you don't have any brand equity. Trying to acquire a customer who's never even heard of you is always going to cost you more than trying to acquire customers who are familiar with your brand in some way, shape, or form. When I talk about this internally, I usually try and explain it to people with a sales analogy of cold calling somebody versus a soft sell. If you're just throwing ads out there and it's completely unheard of, the likelihood that somebody's going to click on them or find you through a search on your terms is very unlikely versus having an ad show up for something that you've heard about, whether it be in the press or whether, you know, you saw it on an ad somewhere else, and really being able to capitalize on that direct response marketing. So it can be very expensive and very difficult to acquire customers when you have zero brand equity whatsoever. And the other thing to consider is that the expectations of somebody that you're dragging into your site are going to be very different than somebody who's just organically finding you on their own. So that's why I kind of, in the slide you just moved to, break out steps that I like to look at as expansion phases and really think about at what point in time does it make sense for you to begin to acquire those customers. And to me, the answer is when you're able to create an experience that would enable you to retain them, because there's no point in buying customers that you can't get to come back more than once.
Interesting. Thank you.
Does that answer that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Great. So for a lot of us, I'd say Jack Threads definitely included in here, maybe with the exception of Canada, we really didn't have a ton of organic demand for our product. So operating under the assumption that the brand equity is very minimal, where can you start and how can you capitalize on some of the organic that you have coming without spinning your wheels and without investing too much up front? And that's, you know, what I call a first phase of cross-border shipping, where you're really just meeting existing demand by shipping your products all over the place. And it seems like a very simple thing to do, but there's actually a number of things involved in it. And as you think about where you're going to ship, you're always going to have market assessment going on and identifying appropriate markets to enter. Your product may be big and bulky, so while it makes sense for some of us to ship clothes and shoes to Australia, it might not make sense if you're selling mattresses. So, you know, there's a lot that has to go into your country selection when you're talking about shipping, but it really is the easiest low investment way to capitalize on any traffic that you're organically getting from customers internationally. And the big things to think about with shipping cross-border are who your carriers are going to be. And Carl mentioned this earlier about true partners versus just vendors that are nickel and diming you. I definitely see a lot of retailers just think, oh, we'll just start shipping internationally with our domestic carrier partner. And it's just super easy and we don't have to do any new contracts. But what you have to remember is that, you know, everything in shipping is volume based, right? So the more volume you do, the cheaper your shipping is going to be, the easier it's going to be competitive. And when you're just starting out in new countries, you're not going to have that volume to negotiate great rates. So you really have to approach your partnerships and your carriers all the way down to shipping as true partners that are holding your hand and jumping in there with you, and really work with that partner to get them to understand your vision and what your brand is and why they should be on board with you, because you're going to make this program really successful even though you're just starting out and it's a slow step. And that type of relationship management that's required may be very different for than the market where you're already very mature and you have volume and you can sort of beat up your vendor for the best rates and that type of thing. So I've seen the most success with retailers who truly approach all of their vendors as real partners to them. There's a handful of other things that get very details when you're thinking about shipping, one being duty and tax management, import and export restrictions. Can you even ship the product to certain countries where you have customers visiting you from? There may be a reason why customers are reaching out and the product's not there, but you're not actually allowed to import it into that country. As well as licensing restrictions. As a multi-brand reseller, we often face that where some of the most popular brands that we sell, we actually can't ship to other countries because those brands have given away exclusive distribution rights to it, and they're coming from different global buying offices. So there's an element of making sure that all the products that you're trying to ship overseas actually can be shipped legally within your agreements and within the import and export compliance laws. And these are all things that there's a ton of partners out there to make this step really easy for you. You don't need to be an expert in duty and tax. You can really learn the basics, and all of the major shipping carriers have teams that are complete experts in this. They're shipping stuff around the globe daily. So there's a lot of assistance, and while it sounds scary to some people, if you choose people that will work with you and believe in your brand, they're going to help you out with all of these things. And then you have to really just work on optimizing your transit speeds with those partners and growing your business and getting the best rates that you can. Any questions there, Carl?
No, I think that's pretty clear. I mean, that's basically the first baby step. I'm very interested in learning about the the next step, which is this cross-border commerce?
Absolutely. So you can have a domestic website and just be shipping internationally, but you're really not doing cross-border commerce at that point. And, you know, when I think of commerce, I think about, you know, actively engaging in how you sell your products. And unless you're starting to customize your site for these markets, you're really just internationally shipping. This is a phase where there's a ton that can be done. And depending on your business and where you are and who your customer is, you could do two or three of these things and not do all of them and still have a very, very successful international business. And this is your chance to really learn, where you figure out what your customer's preferences are and market by market, what are the nuances to transacting online in each of these markets. One of the biggest is certainly currency. There's many markets where customers are comfortable shopping in other currencies. You know, Canadians may be very, very comfortable shopping in U.S. dollars, and same thing with Australians. But that may not be the same in every single market. And in the past, when I've seen even Canadian customers given the option to pay in Canadian dollars or in U.S. dollars, more often than not, they're selecting to pay in Canadian dollars. And they really want to know up front what they're being charged for their product. There's nothing worse than thinking you're paying $100 for an item and then getting your bill and it's $103. And in today's foreign currency market, that $100 isn't really going to be $103 like it's been for the last 5 or 6 years, or maybe 4 or 5 years. It's going to be $125 and $130. And, you know, anecdotally, this is kind of funny, but we have a customer base that oftentimes calls our customer service team to say, hey, can you hold this product for me? I don't get paid until tomorrow. And we look up the product, and they're asking us to hold a $15 sweatshirt for them. So these are customers who are very price sensitive and very conscious about it. And that extra $10 or $15 that they didn't know they were going to be charged could actually cause an overdraft for them. So, you know, that's sort of an extreme case, but knowing what you're paying up front is really, really important. The second is payment options. You know, when we launched, we just had standard credit cards up, and I started talking to everybody internally about the endless amount of payment options there are and how they vary from one country to the next. And nobody quite understood it. They said, you know, everybody has a credit card, they'll just pay with that, or we have PayPal on. And in some of these markets, the best I can explain it is that it's like launching a website in the U.S. and only offering, only accepting Discover cards. And we all know that there's lots of people who don't carry Discover cards. And you could potentially be missing out on a massive part of the market just by not accepting the right payment options. Other than that, you have to start to think about your policy development and not treating your international customers like they're you know, second-rate citizens. Are you accepting returns for them? Are you guaranteeing the price that you're going to return for them? Are you going to be refunding duties and taxes? Are they going to be eligible for the same promotions as your domestic customers? Really thinking about creating policies that mimic an experience that they would have domestically. Certainly, there's a ton to be done for SEO, and you need to start thinking about whether your product is right for that market. So, you know, there may be markets that are just automatically out for you because the type of merchandise that you're selling just isn't appropriate for that market for one reason or another. And then what type of content are you putting out there? And this is a great opportunity to start dabbling with your market. So maybe you want to start acquisition a little bit and you want to run a little bit of paid search and really just extend some of the programs that you have up domestically and start to test the waters. But this is where you have to be really careful, what I was touching on before with Carl, about how much you're willing to pay to bring these customers in because chances are if you haven't localized any of your site, your experience really isn't going to be optimized to get that customer to come back. And depending on your business, it may take 2 or 3 purchases when you've paid to newly acquire a customer before you actually see profit from that customer. So depending what your model looks like and what your financials look like, this is a great place to start testing the waters, but just be careful that you don't go too far and start to churn your customers out just because you're seeing the immediate reaction up front. And there's going to be constant evaluation and of which markets and how you do it and can we use a partner to help us with this. And, again, in this space, there are a ton of partners who are experts in currency and expert in payments and local SEO and everything needed. So really reach out to your partners and understand who can help you do what pieces of this and sort of whittle it down and give you a reasonable action plan.
I just want to express one time again. I mean, I think this is so smart because a lot of people, you know, if you go back to the whole output versus outcome, it's like, oh, once I have this stuff put together, then I'm just going to go big and everything's going to go crazy. And what you're saying is, you know, putting this stuff together is sort of the first part of a good, learning process. And, you know, if you like these early customers, we should be listening to them because you might not have, even though you think you have everything figured out because you went live with your payments yesterday, everything might not work, obviously. And so you might, if you were to go out there big with marketing and SEO, even if you were under the holiday rush, I mean, that could be a big mistake because there could be so many breakdowns that one bad experience from the international consumer and you could lose them forever and their friends.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you touched on a really good point there, again, just going back to the customers. This is like a perfect phase in my mind to really start interacting with your customers. When you're just shipping, it's great to talk to customers and get research for maybe figuring out which of the sort of commerce localization elements that you tackle first. But once you have a couple of them up, it's so important and you're never going to get as much valuable feedback as you will from your customer about what they actually think of what you've done. So before you kind of jump over and you decide to fully invest in a full in-country market and you put tons of resources behind things, really understand what your customers think about it because you need a relatively significant amount of time to figure out what your buyer repeat rates are going to be in certain markets. And it's really tempting to just, see the top line growth going on and then run into that market full force without knowing what a full customer lifetime value is going to be. And by talking to your customers, you can sort of start to figure out how they're going to behave. Get feedback from them on what's working for them and what isn't, and then put all that information into your full strategy that you build on a full market entry.
And another thing, and I can't stress this enough, because almost every retailer we go to doesn't do this, and it's very simple to do. Talk to other retailers in market that have gone through what you're just about to go through. So consumers and that local ecosystem, whether that's, vendors or other retailers or consumers, those are the conversations, when I was saying that 50-50 split, those are the conversations that absolutely must happen. And, a little shameless plug for the Grin community here, that's really what we do, is we help introduce retailers to those ecosystems. So as you spark into the Grin community, that's one of the things that we'd be happy to do for you is introduce you to other Grin members that are in these other countries so that they can help you along.
Yeah, it's a great point, Carl, because I get so much of my information, being a very small team here, from other retailers, and I spend a decent amount of time just really trying to meet people that are in my position and running e-commerce sites and businesses in those local markets that I'm interested in, because they know better than anybody.
Great.
So as you're working and testing all this stuff, you're ultimately really leading up to a full local market entry strategy, and hopefully you've dabbled in localization, and you've talked to your customers, and you've worked with a lot of partners, and you've really started to be able to figure out where your product has a real market opportunity, and where you should be entering and how you should be entering that. And this is a very time-consuming exercise, but, you know, it's really necessary to do a full competitive analysis and make sure you're not entering a market that's just completely saturated with your product already when there's another market that that has a massive gap in the service or product that you're providing. Doing channel analysis and figuring out distribution, people, you know, internally at some of the retailers in the U.S., they cringe at the thought of selling on an eBay or an Amazon because it doesn't have the brand cachet that they want. But in many other marketplaces are the only way to go. And you absolutely can create a fantastic brand experience that isn't just syndicating product out to marketplaces. So figuring out what your channel entry strategy is going to be, going back to your branding, making sure that you set your brand tone the way you want to set it and really cast that brand voice out when you enter that market. And make sure that you're creating a soft sell experience instead of a hard sell for your acquisition team. And then really thinking about your org structure and the CapEx required and the P&L. So making sure that you have the resources that you need to be successful and that everybody's aware up front how much it's going to cost and what the P&L is going to look like and what the ROI looks like. And most of the time it's not going to be year one or year two, or even year three sometimes. So everybody really needs to be on board with what that timeline for success and measuring success is going to look like.
Excellent. Well, thank you. I do want to acknowledge that we have about 8 minutes left. And so if there are questions, Melissa, that are coming through, we can take those now. And I'll also go ahead and put the summary slide up here as well. But I did want to stress something there, Samantha, that you just said, which was, essentially, you know, probably the ROI is going to shift, you know, a few times. And that's one of the things that the GRIN we have an opinion about is that, you know, in a lot of ways, and I'm exaggerating for purpose here, but, you know, business plans are dead in this world. And I think that, you know, when we talk about these companies that are successful, that are doing this, you know, open collaboration, they also spark into the reality of, you know, we need to treat the global expansion efforts as more of a startup. And so if you look at most startups, you know, these days in Silicon Valley and San Francisco, where I'm from, they're not putting a, you know, 60-page business plan in front of investors. They're putting what's called a business model. So if you look up, you know, business model canvas or iterative business model, you'll see what I'm talking about. But a lot of companies, and especially the really smart retailers, are moving into that model so that they can iterate and pivot as they go and learn from the first few stages of Samantha's model so that they can eventually grow into the countries that they're looking to move into. So, Melissa, I don't know if there are any questions, or what we could do here as well is Samantha could, you know, summarize a few of these points.
Yeah, actually, we don't have any questions, but, you know, again, we'd love folks to send them along. We have two great experts here, so it's a good opportunity. I actually had a question, and this is just interesting to me in general. Samantha, you talked a little bit about being found by international customers, the idea of sort of being found, or, you know, folks have to know that you're reaching out to international customers. Can you talk a little bit more about, like, using SEO for international customers? We've gotten questions like that before from our readers. So is there any sort of best practice there? Or
Sure. It's kind of a big can of worms, right? And I'm certainly not an SEO expert, but you want to position yourself as a baseline. Like when I think about putting a store up online, I break it out like this. Customers need to be able to find you, they need to be able to transact, and you need to be able to get them your products. And SEO to me, from a marketing perspective, is just very foundational to organically helping people organically find your site without putting out a ton of money on direct acquisition campaigns. And while it will cost money to set up SEO, whether you have somebody in-house or you have an agency help you, it's really just core and foundational and something that needs to be maintained over time on an ongoing basis. And unfortunately, it's something that you can't necessarily just expand and have it work the same way as it will in your domestic market. So mm-hmm. there is a lot of customization that has to be done to set that up and keep it running depending on how you choose to approach SEO in various markets. And again, there's a number of different ways to do it with how you set up your domains and all of the things that go into SEO. But it's important to know that it's not necessarily going to work. Your U.S. SEO strategy is not necessarily going to work in other markets for a handful of reasons. And if people you want customers to be able to find you for free, so to speak. So right. Being able to capitalize on something without paying out directly for acquisition is super important and can be just a foundational element of when you set up your international site.
Yeah, another good way of putting that, there's no Google in China, and so let's think about that for a second. You know, so at the Grin, we do have several different SEO experts sort of spotted throughout the world that work for several different companies, and I think our general approach is we always, make sure that the retailers are, have several different information interviews across the board so that they get a better idea of what global SEO looks like.
Great. Oh, we actually got a question. Which I think is kind of interesting too. And Samantha or Carl, I guess either one of you guys can answer, but is there what's the most effective way to research popular products that are similar to yours in other countries? Like, is there any way to easily find out if, you're selling a type of widget and that widget is also sold in bulk or something in a foreign country? So therefore it might be a good place for you to start international. There? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, Carl, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Oh, I have, so traditionally we've done a lot of manual research, but I have recently seen a lot of web crawling services pop up that are starting to address this. Just like Amazon has crawlers that check price on competitor sites and things like that. I have recently seen a number of services popping up where you can have them crawl sites in a particular market to look for the same product and then get product information such as price on it and have a point of comparison for yourself. And really, you'll get a lot from a local search engine just searching for your own products. It's just that'll be a lot more time consuming.
Yeah, and I would just add that there's some really good companies, especially in Asia, that do some core analysis around marketplace-driven strategies that do that analysis for companies, and it's well worth the time and money spent with them because they'll analyze everything and share with you. For example, on Tmall, if you're not doing a certain number of conversion with your product, then you're going to be rated lower, so therefore this level of inventory you shouldn't be presenting, stick with this inventory because it's going to move more quickly, it's going to help your ratings, all of that stuff within these marketplace ecosystems is part of that research. And so, it's a lot of fun to, once again, talk to some of these companies to get a better bearing on what to do there.
Yep. We have time for a couple more. One just came in. What's your take on knowing the consumer culture and behavior in deciding which country to enter? So in other words, is it a good idea to do a focus group in a country, or can you just go by case studies, or what's the best way there? Either one of you guys.
Carl, I think you could take that. I know you're very passionate about voice of the customer.
I think it's a good, I mean, I think it's a good question. I think it's the consumer journey, right? So the entire consumer journey is the important point. And I think a lot of people or a lot of retailers sort of see portions of understanding the consumer journey, but not the complete picture. And so not knowing where the context of that question is, where it's coming from, I think
right.
that would be my general answer, is that, you know, let's look at the entire value chain and how your model and your brand, supports that particular consumer's, like that they'll actually, in their consumer path and their consumer journey, they're going to actually purchase from you. Because there's a lot of things that enter into the game now with social and mobile and obviously merchandising, a lot of stuff that we've been talking about that are so important to have that sort of holistic picture when we're thinking about the consumer.
Great. Well, it looks like that's about all we have time for. So on behalf of Total Retail, I want to thank you again for attending the session. And if you're interested in discussing anything that you heard during this presentation, I encourage you to visit the Networking Lounge to chat live with other session attendees. And please also visit the info booth and fill out our short survey, please, to let us know about your experience today. And finally, if you miss anything, know that the entire virtual show will be archived and the on-demand environment will be available for 3 months starting Thursday. So have a great day, everybody, and thanks so much for joining us. Bye-bye.